Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we present a discussion on the magical aspects of Abraham Merritt's, that's 1884-1943, novels and stories of exotic fantasy adventure. Merritt was a highly respected journalist who wrote his colorful tales of the occult and the bizarre for his own pleasure and not as potboilers for the pulps, even though Argosy and other pulp magazines were his main outlet. Now, his work had the quality of literature and the mytho-folkloric erudition of the Robert Graves. Merritt had a library of over 5,000 books on myth, folklore, and the occult. His tales of lost cities, ancient secret cults, and strange otherworldly phenomenon are unparalleled in beauty and imagination. His People of the Pit, 1917, was a profound influence on Howard Phillips Lovecraft, and Merritt's masterpiece, The Ship of Ishtar, 1924, described Richard Shaver's interdimensional simultane concept. And, of course, it was also the template for our pathworking soul travel boat. His Dwellers in the Mirage, 1932, was an inspiration for my science fiction novel, Grillmaster. Now, Merritt was steeped in Blavatsky's Atlantis and Lemurian lore and the obscure legendary sources behind these lost civilizations. His The Moon Pool, 1921, lured us out to the ruins of Lemuria in the Pacific. See beyond Lemuria. So, if you want to spend an hour with the Dreammaker, then come along with us and we'll set sail for Evening Isles, fantastical. Now, consulting good old Wikipedia about Merritt, which of course is a nice article on him, we find that he was born in Beverly, New Jersey, and moved to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in 1894. Originally trained in law, he turned to journalism, first as a correspondent, later as an editor. And according to Peter Hanning, Merritt survived a harrowing experience when he was a young reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer, about which he refused to ever speak. But would, as Hanning claims, mark a turning point in Merritt's life. Whatever that was, Merritt certainly was not quail from adventure. When he was 18 years old, he was down exploring the jungles of Yucatan, back in the turn of the century, and actually uncovering ruins that what they then called no white man had ever seen. Merritt was a world traveler and an adventurer, and a very consummate scholar of folklore and the occult. Really, he was in his own way, a very accomplished cultural anthropologist, specializing, of course, in the shamanic and the cult activity. So he had also an interest in crime journalism and all sorts of action and what have you. So he was not just an armchair scholar, a world traveler, and he was a very, very successful journalist. In fact, he was one of the highest paid journalists in the United States. He was the editor of a Sunday supplement called the American Weekly. Now, I know a lot of you these days, you don't remember. You've probably seen the Sunday supplement parade and some of the magazines. But back before and during and right after World War II, these big newspaper chains, like the Hearst chain that Merritt worked for, they had a weekly magazine that went out with the Sunday paper. And this magazine was as important as was Saturday Evening Post, and it had a circulation, of course. It was tremendous. And so Merritt was the longtime editor-in-chief of the American Weekly. And as I said, at one point he was earning, in 1919, he was earning $100,000 a year, and that, of course, is, gosh, that's well over $500,000 a year, more like getting up toward $8,000 a year, $800,000 a year today. So the man was very, very successful as a journalist, highly respected. But his hobby, along with raising very exotic plants, now I'll give you a little bit of his idea here. He raised orchids and plants linked to witchcraft and magic: monkshood, wolfbane, blue datura, peyote, and cannabis. And who knows what else. Now, this kind of shows up in his stories, because they do have his novels have a psychedelic quality to them. Descriptions are vivid. And in fact, I was mentioning to Zandria before we went on the air that I'm wondering whether or not he's had access to a little psilocybin in there, because his descriptions of his lost worlds and his mysterious hidden empires, they really shimmer and glisten with that electric, glowing psilocybin look. And yeah, Merritt was married twice, both times to an Eleanor, and he died suddenly of a heart attack in his winter home in Indian Rocks Beach, Florida, in 1943, now at the age of 59, by the way. You know, Merritt's writing was influenced, of course, by Y.H. Rider Haggard. She, of course, naturally, that influenced him. In fact, that really was. H. Rider Haggard, she probably was a basic plot line that Merritt used here several times, because he liked the idea of the hero who was a reincarnation of some ancient warrior. He used that a couple of times, and of course that's in She. That was Haggard's plot. And the mysterious, very mysterious, magical female figure. Now, of course, in the case of She, Aisha, She Who Must Be Obeyed, she had a kind of an evil touch to her. Merritt's heroines were usually rather virginal, mysterious, basically good, and usually very, very scantily clad, which of course appealed to teenage readers of the pulp magazines, generally. In fact, if you go on a search, I think you'll find it in Amazon somewhere. Somebody has done a modern reproduction of a Planet Stories with the Ship of Ishtar on the cover, and that is, boy, is that ever sexy. But let's talk a little bit about the magical aspects and how this influences magic. Certainly influenced me. I know when I was growing up as a kid, back when I was 16 years of age, I read The Moon Pool. Now, The Moon Pool was one of Merritt's Lost World novels, and appeared, I think, first in 1918, and then it finally came out. I was in magazine form, and in two different installments. There was Moon Pool, and then there was Conquest of Moon Pool, and they put them together and made and published them as a book in 1921. So when I was 16, of course, that was long after 1921. I know some people think I'm very old, but actually I'm really not that old. I just turned 100 just recently. But I mean, but anyway, so in 1916, I was when I was 16 years old, that was back around 1950 something. And so I read The Moon Pool. And The Moon Pool is one of these Lemurian stories. And it's based on, you know, kind of some Blavatsky and Churchward, of course. And also, Merritt, he wasn't just satisfied with Blavatsky and Churchward. He dug into the actual folklore, really obscure legends, that backed these things up. He went to Blavatsky and Churchward sources. And he was that profound in his research. And so he had got an old account by a sailor from back in the whaling era of the Venice of the Pacific, Don Medull, this fantastic complex of ruins out in the middle of the Pacific, out in the middle of Micronesia on Fonte Island. In those days, they called it Pohnpei. It's now Pohnpei. But anyway, this strange stone city that covered 11 square miles, right in the middle of the Pacific, and nobody wanted to talk about it because nobody could figure out what it was all about. I mean, here's this 11 square mile stone city, completely deserted, out there on this island in the middle of the Pacific, and hardly anybody knows anything about it. So Merritt, with his nose for folklore and all that, and he conceived that there was a pool there in the vault in the middle of the fortress and what have you, which we eventually went to and got down into and everything else. But that's, you can pick that all up in Beyond Lemuria, and you get around to it. But anyway, according to Merritt's story, there was a strange, sparkling, but beautiful but very evil creature called the Dweller that came up out of this pool in the middle of the vault, in the middle of Nan Madol on the island down there. And this Dweller lured people during the full moon into the vault, and it put its mark on them, and they became slaves. And they were taken down into an underground cavern way below the island, this huge cavern, in which the last the last survivors of Lemuria had this civilization that was, now if this is beginning to sound somewhat like the Shaver mystery, that should not surprise you, because Merritt was, not just according to me, but according to Wikipedia, Merritt was quite an influence on Shaver, and he obviously was. So here is this huge underground cavern where you have good Lemurians and bad Lemurians, and they have ancient technology and ancient ray guns and all sorts of interesting stuff. But they also have a race of frog-like creatures that are their guardians, and the dark Lemurian dark forces. They worship the dweller, and he brings them slaves, and they make sacrifices to him. And this dweller is one of these creatures that Merritt liked to create. Merritt liked to create completely alien creatures. I wrote a book called The Metal Monster, of which I'm sure had an influence on the guys that wrote the Transformer movies. The Metal Monster was a metal being that had a hidden complex in a hidden valley in Tibet, and this metal being could compose itself in any number of combinations from different appeared to be platonic solids, but a metal, and it was a sentient being in various components, and it was evil. It was going to exterminate the human race, and in the end, it was sucking power from the sun. This was the metal monster, and so Merritt he was very innovative, and he liked to create these alien beings. One of the stories that he did that, of course, influenced me in my Drillmaster novel was Dwellers in the Mirage. And this was one that was a novel. It was set in Mongolia in the Uyghur area. And you know, the Uyghurs have been in the news lately. They're now Muslims. They had their own religion sometime before Islam. But the Uyghurs are a Turkish tribe in that area with a very, very ancient history, and they had a civilization that goes back into the early 1500 BC, something like this. And they're very little known about them at that time, and a little more known about them now because they're rebelling against the Chinese. But other than that, they had this fantastic earlier civilization. So Merritt, liking to dig into things like that, he actually exploited the idea that Mongolia was the original home of the Caucasoid race, of even of the Nordics, and there is, by the way, I know that sounds like Blavatskian racism and all that, but actually we're beginning to find out now that it's not so fantastic. I mean, we've right there in the South, the Gobi Desert, we've dug up Caucasian mummies I saw a beautiful, beautiful woman, red-haired, with features of just absolutely breathtaking beauty from long before the time of Christ, mummified, wearing, and she must have been almost 6 feet tall, wearing a plaid kilt. And so Merritt was writing a story about this, Dwellers in the Mirage, where this young Norwegian hero is actually the reincarnation of this warrior who was originally one of the lords of the Uyghurs. And so he goes back, and the Mirage is the, interdimensional gateway that they live in. And this hideous creature that they sacrificed to is, this was really a stroke of imagination, the Kraken, that gigantic, giant squid. But it actually, in this story, it was interdimensional. And they fed it on pregnant women, and it lived behind a huge mirror, and they would throw these chained pregnant girls through the mirror into the jaws of the Kraken. Oh boy! Anyway, so that inspired me to take the Kraken and move it into the stratosphere and make an air squid out of it and call it the Mother Drell. And so I had my hero had a previous incarnation. So that obviously Dwellers of Mirage influenced me with Drill Master. Now, I can talk about Merit and the Ship of Ishtar a little bit. The Ship of Ishtar, I think, and I think people who know Merritt and those who science fiction editors and all would all agree on this. The Ship of Ishtar is Merritt's masterpiece. And the Ship of Ishtar, that was 1924. The Ship of Ishtar is an interdimensional story. And it is where Merritt establishes what I think eventually, this was where Shaver really got his idea for the simultane, which he came up with in 1949. This was written in 1924. And, of course, Merritt was quite an influence on Shaver, obviously. So here's how the story goes, so you can get the idea of it. A man who is rather well off, he's an archaeologist, but he's disillusioned. It's the lost generation. He's come back from World War I, and he's suffering from what we now call combat stress disorder, whatever. And they called it shell shock in those days. And he's disillusioned and all, but he has a very good friend, an old archaeologist, over in Iraq. And so he gets this big crate, comes in from Iraq. And he opens up the crate in his room, and the crate has inside it a great big, what appears to be a stone block. But the block isn't all that heavy, and the stone is kind of translucent. And it does have cuneiform carvings on it, and there's a letter, of course, from his friend, the old archaeologist, which is kind of an enigmatic letter telling him he's sending him this block. And that perhaps he can just decipher the hieroglyphics. Well, not hieroglyphics, they're cuneiform. Perhaps he can decipher that, and the old man doesn't have time to, so he's sending the block to him and whatever. So the young man contemplates the block. And he contemplates the block some more, and then finally he taps the block, almost in desperation because he can't figure out the cuneiform, and he hits the block, and the block disintegrates. And it's late at night. The block disintegrates, and inside the block he finds this model ship. And it's about 3 feet long, and it's beautifully detailed, and it's a ship of a period, you know, about 6,000 years old. And it's a galley, of course. It has one big sail, and it has two ranks of oars. But it is all white from the bow to amidships. It's all white, and from the midships to the stern, it's all black. And there are little figures both at the oars and on the decks, and the detail is exquisite. And the ship seems to have some sort of a supernatural quality to it, obviously. And so he contemplates it some more, and the ship emanates a very cloying odor. It's very, very, almost a narcotic odor. And he starts to go into an altered state of consciousness. And then he is overwhelmed, and the walls of the room fall away, and he is drawn into the ship. Now, at this point, what I'd like to do is I'd like to read the description of that interdimensional experience. And the reason why I'm reading that right from the book is to show you, now this is 1924, and to show you, if you pay very close attention to the wording here, you'll see that this is one of the first, if not the first, description of the parallel worlds of what Shaver eventually detailed as the simultane. Now, Shaver's version of the simultane was also influenced by H.G. Wells' time machine, but this was the original template for it. Now, I will go ahead and find this for you in the book, and I'll read it to you. He opened the bedroom door cautiously and listened. He slipped through and back to the room where the ship lay. Lifting its shroudings, he drew one deep breath of wonder at its beauty, and then turned off the electrics. And as his eyes accustomed themselves to the darkness, he caught a dim shimmering where the ship rested, faint reflections from the avenue's lights penetrating the window's hangings. How silent the room had become. It was filling with silence, as a vessel fills with water. Now a sound broke the stillness, the lapping of little waves, numerous, languorous, caressing. He realized that his eyes were closed. He strove with all his might to open them. The lapping of the waves came closer. By an effort, he half raised his eyelids. There was a wide mist opposite him, a globular mist of silver drifting down upon him as though it were the curved breast of another world, an impacting world. No, an interpenetrating world. Fleeting, incredibly swift was the comprehension in the infinitely small point of time it sparked through his mind. He knew it for revelation, explanation, the only key to the inexplicable. By light of that spark, Kenton saw the globe upon which he lived. Not for what it seems, but for what it is. An etheric vibration between the intervals of whose pulsing pulse the electrons of other interlaced worlds upon worlds, children of that primal force whose vibrations are matter in all the guises that we know and that we do not know. He visualized these worlds and his own as congeries of electrons, each in reality as wide apart as the planets from each other. As those same planets from the sun, he saw through the abysses of space between these specks myriads of similar congeries grouped into unseen, unseeable worlds, each world spinning, whirling, yet untouching and untouched by any other, interlaced, interlocked, interpenetrating, embracing worlds keyed to lower and higher pitch than ours, and each in utter ignorance of the other embrace. twice, worlds moving through and about us, worlds registering no more upon each other than do the thousands of wireless messages upon the receiver untuned to receive them, worlds interfering with each other no more than do the dozen messages that freed from contact with each other by their varying scales of vibration pass simultaneously over a single wire. On one of these interpenetrating worlds sailed this ship of Ishtar. Well, that is the blueprint for the simultane. And I don't think that anybody described it quite that fully and that well before that particular period. If so, please inform me. I'd like to know, because I think that's the earliest full description of the parallel worlds theory. And now, the ship of Ishtar is a masterpiece and a classic for more reasons than just that. What we have here is, as Kenton finds out when he gets on the ship, the ship is the eternal prison of the handmaiden of a priestess of Ishtar and the acolyte of a priest of Nergal that have been condemned by the gods to live in conflict, divided on this ship for all eternity. And this came about because 6,000 years earlier, the priestess of Ishtar and the priest of Nergal, the god of death, are the counterpart of Mot. They fell in love, and they consummated this love in the temple of Ishtar, and this was such a sacrilege to the gods that the goddess of love and the god of death that their high priest and high priestess should come together and have this illicit congress was so upsetting to the gods that they held a tribunal, and the gods themselves stood in judgment, and they cursed these two to this other dimension on this ship, where they would forever be held apart by this barrier. And so what happened was that so great was their love that after a certain period of time, they kept trying to come together in this invisible barrier, and their love was so great that they finally succeeded. And they went off to eternal bliss. In other words, love conquered the curse of the gods. But that left the handmaiden of the priestess of Ishtar and the acolyte of the priest of Nergal, that left them to continue in this cursed state. But the difference being, however, that there was no love between these two. The priestess, the handmaiden of the high priestess, was certainly loyal to her priestess. But on the other hand, the acolyte of the high priest of Nergal had betrayed his master. And so his side of the ship and his entourage were entirely evil. And the beautiful Shireen and her in the forecastle with her girls, they were true to the goddess, but they were still in prison. So into this strange, divided world drops the American archaeologist Kenton, and he is, of course, has his adventures on either side of the ship, and he's very much taken with Serene, and she alternately hates him and loves him, and he finally, well, I can't spoil the story for you, but anyway, it is a marvelous, marvelous story. Lots of action, lots of excitement, and erotic in a decent sort of way, but obviously erotic, because Shireen is very attractive and doesn't wear very much, but this is literature. This is really, really is literature, and the descriptions are, as you know, what I've said, it's just absolutely beautiful. Now, Merritt has been criticized, and they even mentioned it here in a Wikipedia article. He's criticized for using purple prose and too many adjectives and all of that, but that actually is not a valid criticism, and the reason for that is this. Merritt's descriptions are not icing on the cake. Merritt's descriptions are the cake. In other words, he is a visionary, and he is way ahead of his time as far as his perception of an altered state of consciousness. Let me put it this way. I'm not trying to say that he was stoned all the time when he wrote these things, but he had a very, very modern way of looking at these ancient, magnificent ancient fantasy and these mythological. The visual descriptions should not be considered purple prose or garnish. If you are romantic, you will appreciate every word Merritt writes. If you're not a romantic, now yeah, sure. If you're not romantically inclined, then you're probably not going to appreciate it. But then, if you're a magician and if you're interested in magic, this man is an absolute master. He isn't just superficially reading about the occult so he can write a story. He is steeped in all of this, and he writes the stories for his own pleasure. He doesn't write them to make money. Although he eventually, his novels became so popular and that he was making money off of this, even though he didn't write them for that reason. Merritt is, as I said, he is literature, and the Ship of Ishtar is a masterpiece. So I would strongly recommend that one. But then again, on the other hand, Moonpool, which we've discussed, certainly has a lot of aspects that relate to things we've done, like the film Beyond Lemuria and whatever, and Kenneth Grant even he liked Moonpool and the Lemurian aspects. So let's discuss some other Merritt work that I think would be very interesting. People of the pit, I said this influenced Lovecraft. Well, you people that are really into Lovecraft, you're going to realize that People of the Pit was the second story he published. The first one was Through the Dragon Glass, and that's a wonderful story about a magic mirror that some wealthy collector brings back from the Boxer Rebellion in China. And come out of the Imperial Palace, and this magic mirror, the dragons start coming alive around the frame, and it sucks you right in, and you go into this magical world inside the mirror, and of course, naturally, there's a beautiful, mysterious woman in there that's going to try to keep you from being attacked by the monster, and by the monster. The monster is in fact the maker of the mirror world himself. And this Through the Dragon Glass is
well, that's a marvelous story. And that's what he started out with. That was his first shot out of the gun. And then he followed that with a story called The People of the Pit. Now, The People of the Pit is the one that really got Lovecraft going, because The People of the Pit takes a couple of hunters up in Alaska, and they're way up there and up toward the Aurora Borealis, and they're looking for this legendary gold country that's up by these particular mountains, and they run into this terribly deformed old former trapper, and this guy is terribly deformed, and his hands are like hoofs. He's been climbing so long, trying to get up out of this underground world, this subterranean world, that his hands have turned into what looks like the hoofs of an animal, and they call him the crawling man, and he's almost dead. And he tells him a story about how he found this mysterious land where the gold is supposed to be, and what it was a pit, a great big pit that had a staircase leading down into it, stone staircase, very ancient. And he kept going down this staircase, and it went straight down, and it switched back, of course, and went straight down like a spiral staircase in a way around the sides of this pit, and it kept going down and down and down, thousands and thousands of feet, finally miles down. He kept going down and down and down, and this opened up like a bottle, this pit, until he realized there was a whole world down there. And a subterranean world, and he got down to the bottom, and there's very strange vegetation, everything else. And then these alien creatures that were sort of like slugs, and he couldn't see them at first, and they chained him, and he made a slave out of him. We finally managed to escape them. But they were telepathic. They had telepathic control over it. And he finally managed to escape. And he crawled up the steps. And this was literally miles and miles and miles up these steps that he kept crawling and crawling and crawling and crawling. And finally, of course, he got to the top. And by that time, he was almost dead. So he, of course, expires after telling the story. And the two adventurers, they bury him, and that's the end of it. Well, now, obviously, this story had a very Lovecraftian, and also Shaver, naturally, was influenced by it. So this was the story, People of the Pit. Now, Merritt did a couple of other things that were a little bit more on the supernatural thriller, or a little bit less exotic, but nonetheless very, very interesting. One of them is called Seven Footprints to Satan, and that's more like a thriller. Satan is he could be a human being. He's kind of a Crowley type character, but he has this huge, widespread international cult, very secret and very, 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 very affluent. And he uses the seven magical footprints of Buddha. And there's a legend. You know, Merritt was always collecting these obscure legends from other countries, other civilizations and all. So Merritt hit this idea of the seven footprints of Buddha. Maybe footprints, and Buddha supposedly took these seven steps and then ascended to heaven or whatever. And so Satan uses these as a game, and you get to walk on the seven footprints, and they light up. And if you walk on the right combination, then you can actually have all of Satan's power if you win the game.
yet all of Satan's power will be given to you. And, of course, he has obviously tremendous power. But if you don't, you die a horrible death. And, of course, everybody enjoys watching that. So this is Satan's game. Well, of course, the game is rigged. Obviously, nobody's going to win. But people keep trying it. And of course, the point of the story, obviously, is that the people that are going to try this game, they probably deserve to get what they get anyway. But it's still, the game is rigged. And this story is not quite the same as the Lost Race and the Lost World stories that Barrett does. He had one called The Face in the Abyss, which also included one called The Snake Mother. This is set down in Peru with an Atlantean kind of a survival thing. And The Face in the Abyss cried golden tears. And this had a lot of flavor to it. And also was a survival, as I say, a survival of Atlantis story. And one of the stories he did was set in the sunken city off the coast of France. This legend of the sunken city called Nice off the coast of France. And this is a very obscure legend, but it's a very haunting and beautiful legend. And the king of Nice is so married. This is a story centered on that. And he did one called Burn Witch Burn, which got made into a film. That featured these animated devil dolls, and the witch produced these devil dolls, and these little animated dolls would go out and kill people. And this is kind of, you know, like Chucky. There have been a lot of different versions of Barrett's Devil Doll story, both on Twilight Zone. And the original film had Lionel Barrymore in it. So this was one that he had. It was made into a film. And one of the stories that I really warmed up to and enjoyed was, let me see here if I can find it, this particular one, I wanted to get the title of it. It was the metal monster that we talked about a little while ago. And what the interesting thing about the metal monster is that he creates a creature that is so completely different from anything that we could conceive of before. It's a living creature of metal that manages to put itself together into various forms, almost like I say, it influenced the Transformers story very, very definitely. And it also is in a presage of solar power. It is sucking power from the sun. It's robbing the Earth's. It has these huge fields robbing the Earth of solar power and solar energy. And this is a very, very kind of a scary concept because, you know, we do derive so much power from the sun. Anyway, Merritt is a terrific influence on both the occult and of course, on other writers of fantasy. So I think he really fits into our magical perspective. And I think that we should especially pay attention to his Ship of Ishtar. And, you know, when I said that the Ship of Ishtar influenced our soul travel boat, But I should mention that Merritt didn't just make this Ship of Ishtar up out of whole cloth. He had
he had the French writer Lane Armand in his collection, and Lane Armand mentions a bark that Ishtar sails across the ocean to reach the underworld. And so he borrowed from that, and that was where he got the idea. But when what we did, when you know, based upon the ship of Ishtar, we created a soul boat, which is all black on the port side and all white on the starboard side to match the two pillars in the temple. And it has, it's shaped like an ibis, in other words, an ibis beak. Those of you who have the pathworking video, you can see the boat on the altar top at the end of the pathworking video. And it has a cockpit, it has a rudder, it has a compass in it, and then it has two candle holders on the thwarts where you put these little colored candles on there. And it has a nice fantail, and it's detailed in silver, and the wings are folded, of course, along the side of the boat. So you place it on top of the altar and point it toward the soul door or toward a hanging mirror, and then you can, make your spirit body very small and climb out on the altar top, get in the boat, and sail through that soul door or mirror. And you can fly over the paths that you have already traversed. That's the idea of it. And this idea actually came from it was derived from the ship of Ishtar, which in turn was derived from Lane Armand. So Merritt has been an influence on us and on Shaver and on Lovecraft and on I'm sure many, many magicians have really, really enjoyed his beautiful stories. And so next week we will certainly have a good show for you. So we'll see you then. And meanwhile, good magic.